This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, your favorite localization and language industry podcaster. I am here just for one reason, to keep you informed, inspired, and hopefully connected to what's going on in the industry. And today's episode, we continue exploring the people, the stories that shapes our industry, from innovation and entrepreneurship to culture and communication. I have the distinct pleasure and honor to have with me my guest today, Vivetta Jean. And Vivetta, thank you for joining me today. It's a pleasure to see you. I know we met in Canada. We talked a couple times online. It was my, you know, pleasure to have sat down beside you in a conference in Montreal, and we shared a meal together and we exchanged ideas. And this is where this podcast came from, is we started that initial conversation together and said, let's expand on that and let's have a conversation online together. Thanks for joining me. Really appreciate it. On this channel, Vivetta, we say everybody's got a story. Let's start by telling the language industry enthusiasts out there listening to us, what is your story? What's your story? Tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
Thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be with you, Robin. Amazing, I mean. And thank you for the invite. It was a great time back in Montreal. So yes, it's all about people. It's about culture and sharing our stories. So my story started a long time ago. And I think from the beginning of my life, I live and breathe localization. My preference for studies was translation. So this is how it started. But as I have shared with many people, at the first attempt, the door was closed, meaning that I did not achieve to enter the university for translation studies the first time. But I got back for the master degree, and my degree is in translation and new technologies. So starting from there, I spent like 20 years with intertranslations. We started small. It was like a company of 5-10 people. And the manager, the owner, Mr. Zainos, did a great job to make this company big, big at heart, big at people. So we grew together. We all became bigger. And this is where I had the chance. And he was very thoughtful. And he had this innovative spirit to give me the opportunity to try myself in different positions. So I had the chance to be a translation manager, a project manager, a vendor manager. I mean, then it was like a head of localization, head of global localization solutions right now, head of translation innovation. So this is all the years that I was inventing and reinventing myself with something new. And this was very important because I have a 360 view of the localization. I have dirty hands. I can understand the pains of all the job titles. And I can touch the heart of people in our industry. And you know that I'm passionate about people. I'm passionate about localization. So this is the big part of the journey. Then back 5 years ago, I managed to take the path of a PhD because I was really immersed in research and in new technologies and in AI and machine translation. So this is how it started. And I'm very thankful to Dr. Wilhelmine Sosoni for having my supervision of the research. So we did great things there about training, about compensation models. I came up with compensation models that could be really useful to, you know, to calculate more the thinking and less the typing of professionals. This is very important nowadays because I don't feel that there is a fair payment method out there. And yeah, that I mean, after that, I finished the PhD in like 1 year ago. And now I'm starting with postdoctoral research, continuing with my passion about human in the loop, technology, AI, and so on. So right now, my current job title is Head of Global Localization Solutions with Intertranslations. InterTranslations, for people who don't know, it is a company started in Athens, Greece, but now we have offices in the UK, and I work remotely for the UK office. And we have offices in France, Paris, in US, and we are growing with tenders. I mean, we have a big part of our business with the EU tenders. We work with the European Commission, with the UN, with international organizations. And at the same time, my part is working with enterprise clients, software localization, game localization, life sciences, marketing, manufacturing, technology, and so on. So this is a little bit of the story. I mean, I didn't share a lot of highlights, but you can pick my brain if you want.
Of course, I'm going to pick your brain. Now, there are a couple of things I want to dig into. One is, how does it feel like working in the language industry in Greece, for instance? And the reason I ask the question is, some of our audience probably are very familiar with the larger markets, be it North America, Europe in general. But no, you know, less conversations takes place when we zoom in on, you know, countries such as Greece or any other country for that matter. How is the language industry in Greece nowadays? Are you familiar with that, or can you give us a bit of an idea what's going on in the language industry in Greece?
I think that it is alike as it happens in Southern Europe, and there is no much or vivid opportunity because everything is like shifting sands. So everything changes right now. But all in all, we are the same as in Europe. I mean, being a language company in Greece, sky's the limit. I mean, you have huge opportunities due to the globalization and due to the fact that we are all working together, huge opportunities for partnerships. So culturally speaking, we're not... If I can explain the tapestry of the language companies in Greece, we're like 4 or 5 big companies. And other than that, there are freelancers and small.
Like the rest of the other countries, right?
Yes, exactly. But then it depends, you know, on the leader. It depends on how much people want, I mean, businessmen want to invest in innovation. And they want to do something at the international level, and of course, the fans.
Is there in Greece, for instance, is there like a national association for language services, like the rest of the countries? Like in Canada, we have a Canadian Language Industry Association. You know, every other country has their own, Argentina, etc. So is there one for Greece?
There are two associations which are for translators, actually. These are for all the people, like members being graduates from the translation, from the School of Translation University. And then there is the Translation Studies Association, again, where, you know, researchers and so on can become members, everyone who has done something with translation. So this is more or less the situation.
Okay. Now, let's go back to you a little bit. And you mentioned something in your opening statement about, you know, one of your thesis for PhD was the pay scale of the translators, paying them based on the thinking versus, I think that was your quote, paying them based on the thinking versus the typing. Can you give us a little bit more highlight on that one? That's very interesting because we want to emphasize in everything we do here is the human element of the job, meaning that you can employ a bunch of technologies, which is fine, but there is a huge element to this, regardless of the tool you use, which is the people. And be it a translator, project manager, it doesn't matter what function we're talking about within the language industry, which is the more essential would be the translator in this case. How does that work from a payment perspective? Can you give us a little bit more details on that?
So regarding this this part of the research, which touches the professionals when it comes to payments. So it was like trying to calculate the effort. So specifically for machine translation post-editing or any post-editing that we may have. So it was about accuracy and fluency first. And we tried to measure how much it was. It was not based on eye tracking. It was based on keystrokes and all the training that preceded the metrics and the measurement. And then out of this, a model of training came out, and then we had the compensation model, like having a basic payment and then have specific factors like weights. And based on that, you can calculate the difficulty of the text and how much effort is needed by the linguist to have the perfect, I mean, the quality text that is needed. So this is what we did. However, I must say that this is not something that is being heard. I mean, I'm happy to share it with you, and I would love people to reach out to me if they're interested in finding more details mm-hmm. about it. Mm-hmm. Because I feel that we all want to have a fair compensation model, but mm-hmm. in reality, it's like pushing it away because we're not ready for it. So I believe sure. that it is really innovative what we did, and it would be a great opportunity for technology providers to have a look and discuss about it. But you know, talking about people and talking about translators, they're waiting for it. And I mm-hmm. think we are there because nobody's going to lose money. Everybody's Nobody. Going to have more out of this. If there is a fair situation and people are happy and they work happy, then, you know, things happen and everything is more balanced in this industry.
Yeah, so the message here is, look, for the audience, yeah, we could be employing a whole bunch of technologies to make things faster, to make them cheaper, but never forget, you know, the quality, it doesn't matter what technology you use, you know, garbage in, garbage out. You cannot produce garbage. You have to produce high quality texts. And consumers and audience are still asking or requiring a high level of quality to be produced. Now, technology is improving. We all can agree to that, but it's improving. With the guidance, with the control of a professional translator who is shaping either the memory, correcting, or teaching the LLM. It doesn't matter what they do, the function in any business or any company in general, they are still involved in enhancing the quality of the output. And that's very, very fundamental. We can talk about the technicalities of how things are done. Doesn't matter. Those are tools in the toolbox of producing something. The outcome, the output is what's still very, very important. We cannot ignore that because if we do, and whoever does it, they're waiting for a scandal. They're waiting for something bad to happen to hit the 6 o'clock news, we call them in North America, to show up on the news somewhere with a bad translation. You don't want to do that. That's not something anybody wants to do. Now, Yvette, we've talked about it when I met you in Montreal, and you told me the story about going through your PhD studies and how important that was for you. From a personal perspective, tell the audience a little bit about how that journey, like what drove you to go through that education process from translator to master degree to a PhD level, and has that paid off for you?
Okay, so this was something I wanted to start like 20 years ago, but you know, the conditions are not always ideal to proceed with a plan like this because it takes like 3 to 5 years and you never know where you will be in 3 or 5 years. So everything is moving around you, but your goal is fixed and you have to be there. So I'm very dedicated to goals. And I said, okay, it's time to start. I was very inspired by the work I did. I mean, it preceded the PhD, it was for Gala. And I had a survey, a webinar on machine translation post-editing. I practiced a lot in machine translation post-editing. I think I was having like more than 100,000 words per month post-edited at some point. And this was a second part of my life. It was after work. So I tested it a lot. I discovered the thinking behind the task. And then I was in the position to share it with the audience. I mean, with Gala, with professionals. I started getting involved in trainings. And I said, okay, this is something I'm very passionate about, and I'm going to start the PhD. And this is how it started. Now, I didn't think about the 5 years ahead. It was a long journey, but I was focused on that. I don't know if it will pay off, and because it depends on how you want it to be paid off. I believe for me, it paid off. It was a challenge, and I met the expectations. The feeling was amazing when it was completed, and every day with it, sleeping with it, or not sleeping with it, it was amazing. Yes. Yeah, it is challenging. When you are over like 40, it is really a challenge because you have family, you have a morning work, you have other things, so it's a lot. But if you want something, you get there. This is my motto. And that's I'm right. happy that I did it.
And I'll bet you feel more empowered now, don't you? After you've done your studies, I feel like it gives you that sense of accomplishment, sense of purpose. Not that you didn't have it before, but it enforces it.
Exactly. It is a self-fulfilling thing and mm-hmm. accomplishment. But in addition to that, and this is what I studied when I was in the process before starting, there was a book about what is meaning to go for a PhD. And it said that this journey, that it takes time, is going to teach you a lot of things about life. I mean, it's not only about a PhD. It's about how you gradually synthesize learning, knowledge, different external factors, and you make progress in life. So this was the most important thing because, yeah, I am empowered, but this is a matter of personality. It's not only about the PhD. It is a matter of how you use this PhD afterwards. If you feel it like a title, it means nothing. But if you feel it like an involvement, like a person that wants to contribute to the society, to the industry, be active, then yes, it empowers.
You have to put it to practice, right?
Exactly.
You have to put it to practice. Now, let's move a little bit, talk about your current work with InterTranslation. Now, you've mentioned it's a big company. Can you give us a bit of an idea how big the company is? Either number of employees, I don't know how you want to qualify that. How big is your company? I know you mentioned there are several offices. And, you know, like if you can talk a little bit about, like, I mean, I don't know if you feel the same. Every time I go to these conferences, I feel that the language industry is crowded. There are many translation industry out there. Just wondering, how do you differentiate yourselves as well? Like, is it by domain, the type of work you do? You know, like some people say, I only do legal, for instance. Can you give us a bit of an idea? We're trying to get to know the company, I guess, in this stage.
The company started back in 1996 with 5-10 people. And now
we're in Athens. Is that where you guys started?
Yeah, in Athens. Yes.
Okay.
And now in Athens, we're like 50 with the sales team, the project managers, the bid department, and, you know, more or less. And then in the UK office, there are another 50 people there working with us, and less in Paris, like 5 and so on. So there are some business units, but I think that this is like locations change, but this is more or less the story of many companies. I think that what differentiates our story, of course, it is the DNA of the leader each time, but more than that, it is that we have the experience of working with international organizations, having all the certifications that are needed, be disciplined. And this is really very important. I think you know best than me how much discipline contributes to growth, because we were discussing about it. So yeah, it is discipline, because you need to do things according to specifications very strictly and be accurate there. And this is something that you learn when you work with a commission, with the parliament, and all the international organizations.
You mean the European Commission, right? For the audience to understand what you're mentioning, right?
Exactly.
Now, okay, so when I hear you talk about the European Commission, I'm assuming you work with government in general, or am I getting this correct?
In a way, yes. It can be governmental, it can be, you know, the Directorate Generals of the Commission.
public sector?
It can be the parliament, yes.
Okay.
As well.
Yeah, so that's good. Now, from a technology, you know, you and I've talked a little bit about this before. Everybody is, you know, I feel silly saying it. You know, it's becoming very redundant to keep saying AI, AI, AI. I'm done with that. I feel like I wish there was a new technology that comes along so we can stop talking about AI and move on from that. But I guess it's still a topic of discussion, still out there. So talk to me a little bit about the blend between the human and the technology at your work. How do you balance it, A, and what percentages do you guess or do you think? Let's say you have a workload of X, you would say probably I'm using 50% technology, 50% human. Can you state some of those factors?
Well, under my leadership, I would say, and management, it is all about technology. It is all about innovation because we're dealing with localization, and localization cannot be a separate thing from technology. I mean, technology is everywhere. I would not say this is the reason I don't name it like this in my PhD title. It's not machine translation. It's not artificial intelligence. It's not LLMs. It is just technology. And it gets shaped every day in a different way. Tomorrow, it may be something else. So this is all about tools. We started with CAD tools, and now it is called AI. And tomorrow, it's going to be something else. Okay, it's not the best thing if someone tomorrow tells you, okay, we have something like GTT or GBD or I don't know what is going to be, but because you have not already digested the previous one and things happen really fast. But you need to be brave and you need to try everything. And you need to be very more intelligent than the tools in a way to be able to master all this technology. So we need to find out how to use our brain more. Now, how much blend? It depends. It depends on the use case. First, you need to analyze your client, your use case, if it is game localization, if it is software localization, if it is not localization, if it is marketing, what is the use of this thing? And then you start working in an innovative way to leverage the best of the tech if allowed by your client, because there is confidential information where you cannot use it at all. And you shouldn't. I mean, you don't risk that. So I don't know if it is 50-50 or if it is 70-30. But it is there in one way or the other every day in our.
So you use it in every day. I mean, the typical to everybody, right? So that everybody uses these technology tools. Depends, and I agree with you. It depends on the type of content that you're trying to translate. Some contents are more susceptible to technology than others for a variety of factors. Security and confidentiality could be one of them. But again, some of the narrow type content, you know, very precise, very risky, I would say, less and less technology. But I mean, technology is evolving and we don't know what tomorrow is going to bring, right? So we don't know if that's going to remain the same or that's going to end up being changed as well. Now, in your opinion, in staying on with the tools and technology, as you mentioned earlier, in your opinion, when you think of generative AI and large language models, what are the biggest opportunities and the biggest risks? I mean, we talked about one of the possible risk factor, which is security and confidentiality. But what are the biggest, in your opinion, opportunities and risk that we can probably think about when it comes to those two types of technologies?
I will not focus on the future. I mean, don't ask me this question about what do you think about the future, what is going to happen and how these are going to be used.
True, like now. Basically.
I will focus on people. So the opportunity and the risk is more or less the same. The opportunity is for people to become more intelligent, and the risk is for people to become more, allow me the word,
stupid or productive, which only one you might use.
I would say that, they will not use their brain. I mean,
the brain
gets passive if the tools are not creatively used.
Correct. You're absolutely correct. Speaking of people, do you feel like you're from a recruiting and training and retaining of your team members, for instance, with all the changes? Because I know like a lot of us in the industry, they like that environment that doesn't change, you know, don't introduce a lot of changes. People don't like change that much. But we live in an era where changes are happening almost on a daily basis in a variety of ways. So how does the human element in your team works right now? Like, is it, do you face challenges in recruiting? Are you finding the right talents? Do you find easier or more difficult to retain them so they don't get moved on to another company, etc.? So the human element on your team, can you describe that?
Yeah, I think that people and professionals are hungry to work. So mm-hmm. there are a lot of hands out there. On our end, when we recruit, it's fine. I mean, we can find what we want. There is no the opposite. I mean, there are a lot of hands, but we don't have a lot of openings for that. Mm-hmm. But what is important is that it's not about the task. It is about the skills and about the willingness to learn. And mm-hmm. there we can see a scarcity. We can see that this becomes less and less, or becomes more stagnant, or you cannot find the people with this mood of, okay, I'm passionate, I want to do things. And I think that this is not their fault, I mean, as potential employees.
Sure.
It is yeah. our fault as employers, because we come from a different generation, and this happens in every culture, and we don't adapt to the new generation. So somehow they need to elevate a little bit, we need to go down a little bit and find a common pace. Because right now, this generation is very different. It's very different. And the culture and the attitude and the mood. So this is where we have the pain, I think. It's not about how many people we can find and professionals, but it is about the quality of people that we find and if they match the culture of a given company.
Okay. Now, when we generally talk about people, and you mentioned a very important point. It's, you know, I thought, you know, from talking to other people, it's sort of like you're in the same idea like the rest of the people I've been talking to. I was led to believe a year ago or 2 years ago, like resources and people are very scarce and you can't find them. But now from past 2024 and 2025, I'm noticing a trend where people are saying, you know, no, you know, we can find people. People are hungry, as you mentioned earlier, to find a job, to find work. Is that an indicative of the slowdown in the industry, do you think?
You have more people hungry, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, this is another thing that technology brings, meaning that we go and boost the ends of the story. We boost the managers and we boost the juniors, but the middle is getting lost. So yeah, there is a lot of hands out there, meaning junior people that you can get. And then we need the managers to be there and the seniors, but in the middle, no, there is not much. That's right. Where we could say that there is scarcity.
And for your company,
you don't need it in the future.
Yeah, for sure. And you don't know, I mean, how technology is going to continue evolving. And I don't predict the future, as you mentioned earlier. You know, we can have a crystal ball and look at it and figure it out. But that's just speculation. And I need a few more drinks before I can do that. the other thing, too, is I want to mention is that I've noticed with, you know, from all the stats that you read, like through the NIMSYs and the Slater and the rest of those research firms, CSA research in our industry, you'd feel like there is a slowdown, but don't know. I mean, our industry, if you depends on how you look at it, right? So everybody can take a number and take a look at the same number from different angles and, you know, generate their own conclusion, right? So some people tell you, oh, the industry is growing because they throw in, you know, $2 billion that Google spent on technology, for instance. Well, that doesn't do anything for the industry, right? So, but in the addressable market, from the local companies such as yourself and many other companies in the local countries or in the local regions, the general mood is that the volume has dropped, or the volume of dollar processed has dropped significantly in the past couple of years. Now, people can tell me we're processing more words, but we're getting paid less for those. And I can't wait for your input on that, because I hear the same. People are processing more words. They're getting paid less for them because the customer is saying, you have tools now, you have technologies. I want to take advantage of those. They're not directly saying that to you, but that's how the RFP process is taking place nowadays. Race to the bottom in terms of prices. Some companies, they refuse to reduce their prices. They say, you know, here's our price. Here's what can I produce. Fine. You want to do business with me? Fine. You don't want to do business with me? Fine too. How does that play out for InterTranslation?
Well, the slowdown is everywhere, but it's productive. I mean, you need the time to digest. You need the time to prepare yourself for the future. And it is like, you know, you slow down to just take the jump. And it's going to be a good thing. Well, I don't see it like, I see it like an opportunity, what is happening right now. Yeah, I can only be positive about it. I mean, yeah, it is less work, but at the same time, I feel that clients, as you said, they find out with AI in their hands, generative AI, that translation is a very tiring thing. So they would not like to have it in-house. So this means that they discover our challenges and probably we get more work from now on.
Yeah.
It is an opportunity.
In terms of InterTranslation, like from a language combination perspective, is there a big demand for, you know, let's say other languages to Greek and Greek to other languages, or Greek is not the center of languages for you? I'm just trying to understand what language combination do you normally deal with?
Well, the main are, you know, EU languages into Greek and Greek to EU languages. It does not affect so much Asian. I mean, we will not have a lot about Asian languages into Greek or from Greek to Asian languages and so on. So it is more focused on Europe in a way.
Oh, focused in Europe. Okay. Now, let's move on a little bit for leadership style. I know you manage a team. You're a leader in your company. So, you know, with all due respect, you're a very highly educated woman. You're running a firm and you must have overcome, you know, you faced some barriers in your career. How did you overcome those barriers?
You don't overcome the barriers. The barriers are there. You just ignore them. I think this is the true story. I mean, there is no real obstacle when you want to get somewhere. If you start seeing the obstacles or turn your head to see what is coming, you lost the game. So yeah, I don't feel like a woman. I feel like a human and I'm acting like anybody else. You know that there is the Women in Localization.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about
association.
That one.
Yeah, and I'm part of it. And I'm a part of the initiative and ambassador of Lock in Pink. But this does not mean that by stating women, for example, you exclude the men. You exclude the humans. So we're all humans, and I would not like to feel in any other way. It is just inclusive. So the same the same barriers. I mean, you should not see it like a barrier. If you start with this, your mind gets blurred. Yeah, there is, but you should not see it. You should say, I'm going my way and nothing will stop me.
Focus on your goal and continue marching forward, right?
Exactly.
Now, this is a message from you to your customers, right? So we're going to try to tackle that one. If you were to say to advise somebody who's facing a large project for involving translation or localization, what would you say to them in terms of the scale? How would they scale it? How do they prepare for it? What do they need to do before they go out and shop for a translation company to help them? What would be your advice? Consider yourself a consultant for those customers. What would you tell them?
So you mean that we have a case where a client comes to me and they want to buy, in a way, the service.
Correct. Yep.
What is the preparation phase? The preparation phase is know your documents and set your expectations. I mean, you could not go for everything. You could not go with one. We go for all. And we need to set expectations in terms of quality, in terms of time. But basically, before you start, you need to know your documents. What is it about? And what do you want to target or to achieve?
The second thing is, so we talked about the customer now. My favorite topic is the procurement people, right? So, and I love our procurement colleagues, and don't get me wrong, I love them all, but there is a certain sensitivity between the buyer and the seller. And we always aim to build a positive connection and positive relationship with everybody. But we understand one thing in the localization industry, that procurement in general don't know how to buy, and I'm speaking in general, right? So don't know how to buy translation. Why? Is because translation is a very small spend in the large company and large enterprise. They don't buy it often. They don't have the, you know, how many times have I seen RFPs? They look, they've been written for a construction RFP, and then they throw the word translation in it. You know, I've seen RFPs asking translated word to wear hard hats. You know, it's just not really the document, or not really familiar with, because a lot of people change too. So, you know, your procurement agent who wrote the RFP this year may not be the same next year, etc. So new people are coming in. And what would be our message to procurement from your side? I have many messages for them, but I'd love to hear from you.
I would say it is the same as with clients, but it is more restricted, meaning that they need to know their potential suppliers' industries, which is really challenging because, you know, there is not like a translation procurement or localization procurement. Normally, procurement in companies cover all the services. They go for everything. They need to check everything. So I think that it is a more, how would they say, regulatory thing, their role. They just need to check that everything is in place. But normally, there is someone behind the procurement that understands and references the provider or the supplier to get to the procurement. So I don't think that there is something wrong there. When you talk to procurement, you talk money in a way. You talk certificates, you talk numbers. You don't talk about what is localization, what is translation, what are all this stuff. Yeah, nobody cares there.
Nobody cares there, yeah. Absolutely. Now, let's move on for the last segment of our conversation, which is the future. And you can look at the future. I'd love to hear your opinion on this one in any way you want, either your future in the industry or the future of the industry in general when it comes to people, technology, process, tools, etc. So give us your view from here to, I don't know, and I know nobody's going to hold you to that. No, we don't have to be very precise. And we don't have to feel any consequences to our prediction, just a prediction. May come true, may not come true, who knows? We're just having a casual conversation about it. Can you give me your immediate down the road look and maybe a bit long term down the road look? You know, say a year to 5 year look.
Well, in terms of what? I mean, would you like me to tell you about the people? I mean, there is no way to talk about the technology. The technology will evolve every day and these things will happen. So it goes higher and higher. But what we can predict the way it goes is that we will need, I think we already covered it in a way, but this is my view of the future right now, that we will have people to execute and professionals to execute the tasks and professionals to be the super experts, be bright minds and be able to master the technology. This mm-hmm. is what I see. And I cannot say if it is good or bad, but this is how it goes right now. We need to find a way to find our values. This is my thinking about the future. We need to focus on the values, on human values, on emotions, on people relationships, on how to partner with each other, to do good things together and make money the nice way. This cannot happen with technology. This is all about people. So people are above only if they understand that technology is made by people and people master technology.
That's right.
Nothing else.
Absolutely. And you know what? And I thank you for that. I really appreciate that, because we always focus in this conversation, in these conversations on this channel, is the effect of a human or the impact of a human on anything we do and everything we do. So I'm glad to hear you emphasizing that. I really appreciate it. A human cannot be taken out of anything that we do. Otherwise, we'd be a complete mess, at least in the near future and the long-term future. It doesn't matter. You still need, because, you know, somebody said it to me before, language is more than a mathematical formula, right? So it's not a mathematical formula in a large extent. In some cases, maybe, but to a large extent, languages are not, and I'm talking about all languages, not English to French, the predominant one, or English to Spanish. I'm speaking about, you know, the 500 languages covered around the world. These are human connected fabric tissues connecting us all together as cultures, right? So you cannot replace that with, it would be a very complex mathematical formula if you want to get that. If you want to get to a place where, you know, technology can feel, can have empathy, can have a reaction to a context, to a history, to tradition, it's crazy to think it that way, because most technologies I see right now, AI is one of them. AI, people tell me it's an artificial intelligence. I say, no intelligence. It's artificial something, but it's no intelligence. You know, I had on this podcast, you know, a couple of, you know, professors from a couple of universities, PhDs, they're teaching this stuff, AI, in some of the colleges. And they all agree to one thing. It is not as intelligent as that people may think. It's still a database function, meaning that we're still doing database vectoring, indexing, and we're still gathering patterns out of content that we fed the machine. Basically, it's recognizing pattern at this point. The reasoning part is full of hallucinations. You know, you read stories, right? So it was on the news the other day. Somebody in the United States, I think it was, or somewhere, I can't remember. I was flipping through the channel. I see this news. It says, this guy goes to court. He's divorcing his wife, or his wife is divorcing him. And the judge asks him, he says, so why did you cheat on your wife? The guy goes, well, I checked with ChatGPT and recommended for me to cheat on my wife. You mentioned earlier, it's going to make us stupid. Well, it's making us stupid now as a humanity. Like, it's crazy the way things are moving. But I want to thank you so much, Vivetta. Any last word before we stop the recording?
Last word. Okay. I would say believe in the future and embrace the future. We shape it.
Absolutely. Together we'll make it better. Thank you so much, Vivetta, for joining me today. I really appreciate it on episode 122 of the Localization Fireside Chat. And to the audience, thanks for sticking with me till the end of this video. I really appreciate it. Hopefully you got something out of it. Most of our videos, generally people get some gems and some nuggets out of them. Hopefully this one have delivered as well, like the previous episodes have done. Thank you so much for joining me. If you don't mind liking, sharing, commenting on this content, I really appreciate it. It helps me and it helps the channel quite a bit. Again, this is a personal effort, not funded by anybody. It's funded by myself, Robin Ayoub. It runs on passion fuel, I call it, and that's it. So thanks so much. I'll see you at the next episode. Vivetta, thanks so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.